All right, hi everybody, and welcome to Lecture 83 in this American History program of History at Our House for the junior and senior high class. Today's lecture, we're going to continue to observe a transition in American culture, a very important transition. We started into this part six of the program. And in these final chapters that we're going to be studying over the next few weeks, we're going to see that America is going to conduct itself as an international police power. This is something that the United States does currently and has been doing for about 100 years consistently. And that this is contrary to the original advice of America's founding fathers, represents a departure from original American values, and therefore creates a really interesting dynamic in American culture. America is not entirely as a country, because it has a history, a very successful and positive history of behaving in a different way, is a culture that has a conflict over this. And it is observable whenever things happen, whether they are in the Middle East or Ukraine or some small part of Africa or pretty much anywhere else. And so this is going to continue to be a feature of the world that you live in. And you'll have to sort through this in your own mind. And as a voter, for instance, you'll have to choose between candidates that will, in all likelihood, represent one or the other side of this equation, or perhaps a mix in some sort of way. And you're going to have to sort that out for yourself if that's the America you want to live in. So it's a very present-centric issue, the conduct of America in the world. And what we're going to see is, as a result of the events we saw last time in 1898, America began to change its conduct and adopt this policing role. So we begin with the situation in Cuba and how this challenged Americans. It was the first time there was a kind of situation that was, it wasn't crystal clear. It wasn't necessarily easy to know what to do. Even from the perspective of the Monroe Doctrine, you could look at that and you could say, well, shouldn't America get involved in helping a neighboring country, such a close neighbor, in Cuba, to become independent from the oppressive Spanish Empire? This is something that Americans were grappling with. And the Monroe Doctrine, we talked about, what did the Monroe Doctrine say about that? In principle, the Founding Fathers would say that the purpose of the American government is to protect the rights of Americans, and therefore getting involved in the wars of other countries, unless those wars represent a direct threat to the rights of Americans, doesn't make sense. The purpose of war is to protect your citizens from foreign aggression. If there is none, then you don't go to war. At least in the American concept of war, as presented by the Founding Fathers. You don't go to war unless the rights of your citizens are under attack. So what about in this case? Was that, in fact, the case? Or was it, remember last time we were kind of batting this back and forth, I was trying to get you to see it kind of from both sides, consider how strong of an argument you could make either way. Was this perhaps kind of similar to the Louisiana Purchase scenario, where Cuba's kind of similar to the Louisiana Territory? It's a neighboring region. We don't want it to be ruled by another empire. And I think we ended up agreeing that no, it's not the same. That there was no direct threat from Spanish colonial rule in Cuba. And there was enough of a distance, enough of a buffer, and basically no threat to America. And that was proved by the fact that Cuba had been part of the Spanish Empire for over 100 years, and Americans weren't getting hurt there. So, in the end, when you looked at the situation in Cuba from the Monroe Doctrine perspective, there wasn't any way to go to war there. So, getting involved in war there would have to involve a different point of view. Would have to involve a different way of looking at the issue of what the American government is supposed to do. And part of it had to do with, oh, how terrible, how brutal the Spanish Empire is. The poor Cuban independence fighters were being brutalized, being put into concentration camps. It was awful. What should America do? It was awful. But did the American government command American citizens to go die because that was happening in another country? Was that the right response? It got a little bit cloudier, as we saw, because the American government sent a battleship to Cuba. That's what we call a show of force, to kind of to say, hey, we're here, just you know, you guys are having your war here, but just to remind you, the United States is right next door, and we want to make sure that nothing bad happens to Americans. The irony of that was the battleship was destroyed in the port of Havana. And that ended up being part of how America got dragged into the war. And decided, okay, we are going to help our neighbors, Cuba, to become independent of the Spanish Empire. That's all, you know, just a, that's all review there of our setup for the transition to interventionism that we are going to see. Today we're going to talk about how helping Cuba was the first step in a transformation. One that wasn't necessarily undertaken with full understanding and or without any reservations or conflict by Americans. But it was a transition that happened and it started there. And by the time America was done with this transition, it had become the world's police power. It went from helping Cuba to policing the world. So how did it happen? We've already got one of the components of how this mostly a kind of unconscious transformation took place, anyway, how the by what steps this transformation in America's culture took place? Because we've got Cuba on the one hand, right here, as we know, next to our United States, and this is kind of the whole part of the reasoning to get involved here is because it's a neighbor and it's so close and. And we don't want the Spanish Empire in charge of a neighboring territory. But getting involved in this war had, by itself, just this, what we end up knowing as the Spanish-American War, just by itself started America down the path to being a world police power. Why? What does this particular map help us to grasp? The clues are in red. Why did this war put America on a new path? The clues are labeled in red. Juliet?
Well, because Spain was a global power, America had to fight a global power. And then they won, so they got all this lands overseas, including Cuba, but the Philippines and things over there as well. So it just became bigger than they thought it was going to be.
Okay. Okay. Crucial point. Spain was a global power. If you choose to go to war with a global power, you don't have the luxury of saying, please only fight me over here. Right? If Spain, and in fact, Spain did have a powerful fleet in the Philippines, that was a threat. The United States needed to deal with that. But by destroying the Spanish fleet in the Philippines, which the United States did, the United States essentially became the protector of the Philippines, or became the power that now was in control of the Philippines. The Filipinos themselves could not possibly have, at that point in their history, made their own government. Many of them were very primitive and couldn't really hold on to the islands themselves. If Spain had decided a couple years later to go back and reconquer them, it could have. If China or another Japan or another country decided to conquer the Philippines, they certainly could have. So the Philippines were not going to be independent on their own. The only way that they could stay independent was if the United States helped. Same thing went for Cuba. So the United States got itself into a situation where in order to grant independence to Cuba, it had also rendered the Philippines independent and couldn't see how to not stay there. Now, the Monroe Doctrine would say, well, good luck to the Filipinos. You know, that our job is not to help you make a country. Our job is just to defeat Spain. And so now that we've done that, we're going back home. But what's interesting here is we're starting to see a different way of thinking about this. And Americans looked at that situation and said, we should stay and help. We should be a new kind of great country in the world. Switch in thinking going on here. Great countries in the world, if you studied history, you would say, well, what great countries do is they conquer each other, they create empires, they rule other parts of the world. If you got a question, raise your hand. And so you could look at the Persian Empire, the Roman Empire, China, Russia, the British Empire, any empire in the world. It's always empires. Great countries conquer each other. Now, the United States was here liberating parts of the world through war against, it's kind of like an anti-empire. But now, what was it to do with these regions that could not stay independent without its help? It needed to, assuming it wanted to help them, it needed to practice a new kind of benevolent imperialism. This is what it means to be a world police power. In fact, there's a really interesting poster from the presidential elections in 1900 that had to do with what the administration had done. And this is a really fascinating poster because it, you know, think about how modern elections have been like if you've paid attention to them, or if you're paying attention to what's going to be happening in 2016. You know, we have different people stepping forward and saying what it is that they represent and so on. This is what it was like back then. And Americans were saying, well, look what we do. What America is this great country. And we practice a new kind of benevolent imperialism. Do you see it in the slogan? What's the difference in the American kind of empire? It's new. It's got a new premise in it. What is it? It's right here. What does this say? Timothy?
The American flag has not been planted in foreign soil to acquire more territory, but for humanity's sake.
That's a new way of looking at it. Look at this over here. This is Spanish rule in Cuba. That's old imperialism. Look at those poor people. They're chained up. They're in a prison. It's awful. This is a look at what it says. American rule in Cuba. Doesn't it look nice? You see what the sign says? It says public school. So the kids are going to school. The farmers are farming the land. The factories are growing up. Isn't that wonderful? American rule in Cuba. It's not an interesting expression, though. Rule. A new kind of benevolent imperialism. For humanity's sake. This indeed was the type of idea that Americans were starting to warm to. That America could do something that no other country could do. That the purpose, that America could take on a greater purpose. That it would be a champion for all of humanity to make the world a better place. Theodore Roosevelt here is really the first of the presidents. Right here, he's vice president, but going to become president. He's the one who's really going to now make the case that the United States needs to behave in a different way. Now, and it starts with kind of consequences from this war. Right, we've got this. We've got the United States has now liberated Cuba from Spain and liberated the Philippines from the Spanish Empire. Okay, what next? Well, being a global police power is pretty challenging. For one thing, you've got the United States here, and it's a really big country. It spans the entire North American continent. So that helps in a sense that you've got this presence both on the Atlantic Ocean and on the Pacific Ocean. So that's good. You can kind of go either way, right? But if you're going to commit to policing either side of the world here, basically, with America, you know, thinking of America as being in the middle, if you're going to commit to policing the whole thing, how are you going to make sure that you really have a good coordinated presence on both sides? Because, you know, on the one hand, you got the West Coast over here, you got the East Coast over here. And to be a world police power, what did that involve? What were you going to have to do? How could you go out into other parts of the world and police them? What did that involve? At this time in history, 1900, let's say, when the airplane hasn't been invented yet. Technology-wise, transportation-wise, how could you be the world police power? There's only one way. Bria?
Battleships?
Yeah, okay. You know, with a navy, basically. You know, overall, you would just say by means of naval power. You had to transport people and supplies and weaponry, in the case of wars, you know, by ship. So, if you're the United States and you're starting to think of yourself in that role and you look at the geography of the world, you have an interesting problem here. The problem is that, well, on the one hand, you've got things over here, and on the other hand, you've got things over here. But they're separate. Now, if you want to move supplies across the country, you can kind of do that, right? We know we've got industrial technology now. There's transcontinental railroads. You can move stuff back and forth. That's true. But what about this, if you want to have a global navy that's going to police the world, you've got some peculiar challenges here. Because you're going to have a navy over here and a navy over here. Which you can do. But if you want to do that well, you're better off being able to coordinate those. Right? And, well, it's not easy to do. Because you've got your navy on this side, right? And you got your Navy on this side, but how connected are they? Really, very difficult to do. Because basically, you've got to, if you want to connect them, you're going to go all the way around South America, which is this long. Right? So how do you make a connection between these two navies, right? It's you got this continent-sized obstacle in between the two sides. Wouldn't it be nice if you could just sneak through here? Right? And there's this really, really narrow part here now. And with all this modern industrialized technology, as the Europeans had proved over here, does anybody know what this transportation corridor is called over here? It was completed in 1869. In Egypt. Did you guys catch that? Nobody's, yeah, Yukon, you guys know what it is. The canal over here? I think you've heard of it and you just forgot it. The Suez Canal was constructed in 1869, linking the Mediterranean Sea to the Indian Ocean so that European merchants didn't have to sail around the continent. Right? Now what about over here? Couldn't we do the same thing? We got this industrial, you know, technology now. Can't we make a man-made channel through to link the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific Ocean without having to go around South America, which is really perilous and long? So the United States was interested for the purposes of international policing, but beyond that, just for the purpose of international trade as well, right? Because there's any international transportation, communication, trade, all of the good stuff that went along with globalization, wouldn't it be great to not have to always go around South America or rely on railroads to get stuff? I mean, shipping things by boat in globalization is basically how it's done. And if you can't sneak through Central America, you got to go around South America. So the United States became very interested in the concept of a Panama Canal. The problem was that there was no such country as Panama. In 1900, as you can see from this map, the red here is the crucial point. This was called Colombia, which of course parts of it still are. And as you can see, this part here, the narrow part, which today is Panama, was just a province of Colombia. What we would call a state. I can't remember if they called it a territory, a state or a province. I think it was a province of Colombia. And the Colombian government did not want to make a deal with the United States for the construction of a canal. There was a perfect spot to do it, right here. And the United States wanted to build a canal there, but wanted to make a deal with Colombia over controlling the canal and so on. So Colombia wouldn't make the deal, and it wasn't going to happen, which was very frustrating. But the United States saw an opportunity because the province of Panama had an independence movement going. Panama wanted to secede from Colombia. So this created a new, interesting challenge of conduct for the United States. What to do about this here? You've got a country. It won't kind of play ball. It won't make bargains with the United States in a project that's really important to making the world a better place. The United States can be an international police power and global trade can be expanded and life will be better for everybody for humanity's sake. But Colombia's in the way. And then, The Panamanians want to be independent. What should we do? Bria?
If it were me, I would say, hey, you want to get rid of Colombia, so we'll help you if you make a deal with us and we can make this canal and we can go through this state.
Aha! So you are on board with being a world police power, I see. So this is exactly what Theodore Roosevelt did. Made a deal with the Panamanians and said, we will support your independence from Colombia. We will support your secession from Colombia if you'll make a bargain with us over the canal. Well, let me ask you this. How appreciative would you have been of, let's say, Britain deciding to support the Confederacy when it seceded from the United States in the Civil War? When one part of a country secedes from another, that's the business of that country. Would the United States have tolerated other countries helping the Confederacy? What kind of behavior is that? Now the United States is helping in the secession of one part of a country from the rest of that country. Would there be any important difference between those two actions? Would it be right for the United States to help in the dismantling of another country just because that country doesn't want to make a deal with the United States? Because that's what you're suggesting. That the United States should help part of a country secede from that country. Dismantle another country because it wants a canal. Those are kind of the two sides in this challenge, I would say, concerning America's foreign policy. Because there are plenty of people who would look at this problem and who would say, yes, the United States should do that. The United States, you know, needs, if the United States is going to help people all around the world and Colombia is getting in the way, well, then too bad for Colombia. This is a project for humanity. So we're going to go ahead and dismantle this country, and we are going to do something that's for the greater good, so-called. On the other hand, the other perspective, the founding fathers would look at that and they would say, this has nothing to do with the rights of Americans. America is not a country that goes, or should not be, is what George Washington would say, or James Monroe, should not be a country that would go and dismantle other countries in the world, because this has nothing to do with the rights of Americans. So those were the two kind of ways of looking at it. Theodore Roosevelt was of the view that being an international police power was the new purpose of America, and therefore he should help Panama to become independent, which did happen. Panama did become independent and agreed to a deal with the United States to construct the Panama Canal, which was accomplished by 1914. So now the United States had helped Cuba to become independent, had liberated the Philippines from the Spanish Empire, and helped Panama to secede from Colombia. So you can see we're starting to pick up steam here. We've got three different episodes of intervening in the affairs of other countries that have nothing to do with the rights of Americans, but it's just starting to get, the ball is just getting rolling here. Now, and not all Americans agreed with this. Not all Americans liked the way that the United States was now acting. Not everybody thought that it was proper. This was now a challenge. And Theodore Roosevelt understood that a lot of Americans looked at this and said, well, this is not the way that the Founding Fathers would want us to act. And in 1905, he gave a speech. It's a very famous speech. Well, in fact, it was, well, 1904, 1905, thereabouts. And so Theodore Roosevelt is the president. And this speech is known as the Corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. I'm going to put a link to this on the class webpage. And it is a very serious discussion of the foreign policy of the United States with regard to the world at large. You see it right there. And he's saying, you know what? We got a serious question in front of us. We have got to figure out what is the United States' action going to be towards the rest of the world. This was exactly the right moment to take that question seriously. And so he started to explain his point of view. And as you can see, he wanted to connect his point of view to the Monroe Doctrine. So he called it a corollary. Does anybody know what a corollary is? Good vocabulary word. Corollary. Do I have a dictionary here online? Let's go to dictionary.com. A corollary is what? An immediate consequence or easily drawn conclusion, a natural consequence or result. Those are not the best definitions I could think of. This is the best one right here. A proposition that follows directly from the proof of another proposition. An obvious deduction. Okay, keep that one in mind. Something that follows immediately from something else. So, for instance, if you agree that there is a right to property, then a corollary to that is that anybody that enters your property against your will is trespassing, and that's a crime. It's a corollary. It follows immediately that anybody who violates your property is a trespasser, is a criminal. So that's the idea of something that follows immediately from something else. What Theodore Roosevelt was saying was he's now going to help Americans to see that being an international police power is actually a corollary of the Monroe Doctrine. You should take that down and process that. Being an international police power is a corollary of the Monroe Doctrine. How does that work? It's going to be right here, embedded in the speech. Adherence of the United States to the Monroe Doctrine may force the United States to the exercise of an international police power. Now he's saying the Monroe Doctrine actually means that we should be an international police power. The Monroe Doctrine doesn't mean that America should stay out of the affairs of other countries. It actually means, in some cases, that it should be a police power. And he goes on to explain why. Now remember that the Monroe Doctrine says, and the Founding Fathers overall said, the purpose of American government is to protect the rights of Americans, and therefore, we shouldn't get involved in the wars of others. All right, so now let's see how Theodore Roosevelt makes a kind of a switch here. First of all, we only interfere when. What does it say here at first? Interference becomes a part of the Monroe Doctrine when? All the time? Only as a last resort. Oh. And only when the rights of Americans are violated. Well, that does sound like the Monroe Doctrine, doesn't it? Doesn't that sound like it? If he had stopped there, it actually would be pretty much the Monroe Doctrine. Oh, okay. So what you're saying there, Theodore Roosevelt, is that the United States should actually police other countries if there's no other choice, that the rights of Americans are in danger, and therefore, you know, that's the only way to take care of it. Okay, that sounds pretty much like what James Monroe said. Yeah, okay. But notice that it's not all he said. The most important word in the entire Roosevelt corollary, right there, two letters. Or. Was there an or in the Monroe Doctrine? Was there an or in George Washington's neutrality between France and England? No. There is one here. And this or, in strange-sounding language, basically says, or when things aren't going terribly well out there. That's about it. Or when things aren't terribly going... Or when other countries had invited foreign aggression to the detriment of the entire body of American nations. Huh? What does that mean, the entire body of the American nations? That's gobbledygook. Or gobbledygook. What's the expression? What does that mean? It just means, or there's a problem out there. There's a detriment. The word detriment is, you know, something's gone wrong. So, in other words, the United States should intervene in the affairs of other countries if the rights of Americans are at stake or something's going wrong. And this is the new version of the Monroe Doctrine. Clever language in here that is hard to decipher, but that's essentially what he's saying. So we have a new way of looking at the question, a new way of thinking about it that says there's not just one standard for deciding how America should act. It's not just the rights of Americans. It's whenever there's a problem out there. Well, what problems? What do you mean, whenever there's a problem out there? What if it's not just a problem in the Americas? What if it's not just Cuba or Panama? What if it's Europe? What if there's a war in Europe? And that is to our detriment. Now what? What do you think? Can the Monroe Doctrine be stretched that far to say we got to take care of America, but if there's ever a problem that worries us over in Europe, we can still take the Monroe Doctrine and make it fit that? Could that be done? Either I've lost you guys or nobody's got the guts to say yes or no. Which one is it? Because I know it's a little tricky issue. Know what, Juliet?
No, I don't think you can stretch that far.
Okay, so do you agree with this stretch? Is it a corollary to say that the Monroe Doctrine can be used to justify interference in the affairs of other nations in the Americas? Do you agree with that stretch?
It's a stretch, but probably yes.
It's a stretch. Okay, so President Roosevelt has made enough of an argument that you think, oh yeah, we could follow that along. And I think quite a few people would have agreed with that stretch. In particular, he would say, well, the problem is, especially that if we let things go wrong in other countries in the Americas, then, and we don't do anything about it, then the Europeans will get involved. Because they're, the world police, they're the world bully powers. And we know how they act. They did it in Cuba. They do it other places. We know what kind of powers they are. So we don't want them getting involved. It should be America getting involved. It should be America creating this much, oh, wait a minute, where did it go? This grander kind of imperialism. Right? An American acquisition of territory for humanity's sake. That's, we could take the Monroe Doctrine and kind of make it mean that now, because we've got to reinterpret it kind of for the modern world. But what about Europe? Juliet's thinking, no, you can't stretch it that far. I mean, that would be, let's just say that it's a stretch. I don't think it's a stretch. I think it is. It's an actual contradiction, in fact, of the Monroe Doctrine. But if we call it a stretch, we try to allow it to be a stretch, then the Monroe Doctrine does very explicitly say the United States and Europe must be kept separate. The United States and Europe must be kept separate. That is just so plainly, in very clear language, what the Monroe Doctrine says. So if there's a European war, can you take this new Theodore Roosevelt approach and say, well, now America should get involved in European wars? The only way you're going to do that is if you can jettison the Monroe Doctrine. You've got to be able to throw it out completely. Because there's no way to stretch it or even pretend that you're stretching it. Because the founders were too explicit on that, were too clear and absolutely consistent in not getting involved in European wars. In 1914, a new European war begins. It's going to be worse than any ever before. It's going to become World War I. Should the United States get involved? Was the big question. By following the Monroe Doctrine? Absolutely not. And yet, the United States did get involved in World War I. So, we know that something changed. We see it changing. We've seen a trend. We've seen a slow transition from Cuba to the Philippines to Panama. A different type of thinking involved in making America a benevolent empire in the world. Up till that point, you could make an argument that this was still workable within the advice of the founding fathers, that it was still something that was agreeable to the Monroe Doctrine, that America hadn't really changed, it was just adapting. But what about a war in Europe? No, that was not going to fly. So we're going to see that when the time came, Americans absolutely did not want to get involved in World War I. And yet they did. So how do you go from one to the other? How do you go from a country that completely doesn't want to do something to a country that's jumping in with both feet? That'll be the puzzle for us tomorrow. All right, we'll get there. Thanks, everybody. That's it for today. Bye for now.
Bye, Mr. Powell.
Bye-bye.